Welcome, Bankless Nation, back to the roundtable. Here with me today is the man with glutinous glutes, Zero X Bread Guy. Good to see you.
Hey, guys. Back for another week.
And we've also got crypto's chief lowercase r researcher, John Charbonneau. Welcome back.
Yo, how's it going?
And last but not least, the world's most zen DGen, Andy8052. It's good to see you.
Hello, hello.
All right, so we got some drama to pack through this week. The movement drama that came out Friday of last week, we're going to talk about that. There's some boop.fun discourse, which we're going to unpack. Maybe something that's actually pretty big that people are under-indexing is Apple's new iOS meta and its impact on the commerce economy in the App Store, which is inclusive of crypto. When this podcast goes live tomorrow, Pectra, the Ethereum upgrade, will be live, and so that's where we're going to talk about that as well. But overall, I was kind of just powwowing with Bread as we got started here before we hit record about, like, we started doing these episodes and then things on crypto Twitter just started to calm down right as we start doing these roundtables. Kind of unfortunate, but I think we're going to make the most of it. Bread, what you thinking about, my man?
Yeah, I do a daily show too, right? So like we have to talk about stuff pretty routinely, not daily. And had the same conversation earlier this week where it's like there's a huge disconnect with like the structural bullishness of the industry right now and like just the general sentiment you have on like crypto Twitter. I know last week John was even pointing out that and I don't even know it was on chat or in the actual conversation, is just like, yeah, the alpha on CT hasn't really been there recently. So it's like, you know, kind of disconnecting myself from it. He was saying that. But yeah, like it's kind of felt that way. And even as someone that's like on the timeline trying to engage, like maintain the conversation, lately, it's just like I haven't felt strongly about much of the stuff that has hit the surface. So most of it's just like drama based, so I avoid it, or it's just like not really intellectually exciting, so I just like, you know, don't speak on it mostly. So yeah, I felt it too.
Mm-hmm. I do think the movement drama has kind of hit what might, there's probably going to be more drama, but it's really hit a nerve of people
crescendo,
feeling
yeah.
despair about like, why are we continuing to get into this place? You said, Brad, structural bullishness, the mismatch between the structural bullishness of the industry with like the despair on the timeline. And that is what I see. I see a lot of people say like institutions have never been more bullish about crypto before. The amount of inbound from Wall Street is the highest that it's ever been. And then like the despair on the timeline is also the highest that it's ever been, which is like an interesting gap that we haven't really seen before in crypto.
Do you think it's because we see that on the horizon and everyone's kind of like knife fighting to make sure that they're the ones that are positioned to get the structural bullishness? Because like, I know there's like some self-consciousness right now going on with, you know, Ethereum, Solana, like what's the right direction and stuff. And, you know, we feel like we're there, like we're on the precipice of something, but like you're unsure if you're going to be in the group that misses the right. wave. Yeah.
Yeah, we all know that the music is about to be up and there's only so many chairs left. What's up, Andy?
Yeah,
I feel like a big part of it is just like Bitcoin dominance can explain a lot of it, where it's just like, I mean, I would argue that probably everyone on crypto Twitter, myself included, is underexposed to Bitcoin compared to how much time we spend in the industry. And like as Bitcoin dominance goes up and up, it's like, oh, crypto's doing well, but I'm not actually making that much money. And like, you see stuff like movement and all these different things, and that's just like really disheartening. Or you see, like, I saw images of like Starknet's token chart going around this morning, going from like $26 billion to $1 billion and all that. And I think a lot of it would go away and people would feel differently if Bitcoin dominance started going down.
You know, there yeah. was a, yeah, well, John, get in there and then I have something to follow up on that.
Yeah, it's following on that. I'd say that's like half of it, but it gets to the same point of the big split, which is why it makes sense, is all the institutional stuff like sounds great of, yeah, you go talk to more institutional side. Everyone is, you know, peak of positive sentiment for the most part that you've had over the past few years. But the things that all the institutions are interested, one is Bitcoin, which like we said, is like CT is just chronically underexposed to. And then the other half of it is, I would say, like pointing at, you know, somewhat growing concern with a lot of people of like, okay, but what if the institutions come in and then basically none of our coins win? And this is basically, you know, like I've heard people say this a bunch of times, like Robinhood is just going to show up and be like, hey, thanks guys for building all this open source software. Yeah. This is sick. We're going to copy all this. And yeah, exactly. And then like Coinbase, Robinhood, and JP Morgan end up winning.
And Tether.
And like, thanks for building everything, guys. So, I mean, like, there's definitely some truth behind that of, you know, a lot of those businesses are going to come in increasingly and they are going to start to squeeze and compete. I'd say a mix also is a lot of the stuff that people are super positive on right now with stablecoins. And it's a similar bucket of everyone would love to own a piece of Tether right now, but nobody on CT also owns a piece of Tether. I mean, Circle's kind of underwhelming with their financials that they put out, even though they are going to IPO. A lot of the stuff that is going well is just like, it's not the stuff that CT and a lot of us are actually exposed to and spending time on the investment side. Bitcoin is the one that like everyone can, and it's the one that everyone just chooses not to own enough of all the time.
Yeah, the revelation that I had, or maybe just like coming to acceptance of, was, you know, the bullish case for smart contract platforms for me over the last few years is just like, TradFi loves yield. They love yield. We're going to create all this new yield that they're going to want to come a part of. And then as the ecosystem has matured the last year, it's less that we are creating our own useful yield and more that like they just want exposure to the yield that they've always had exposure to, just in a more efficient form, which is like stable coins and, you know, just a few treasuries that they're doing. Like that's nothing we do. That doesn't plug into like the DeFi the same way as like we do. It doesn't do any degen games. It's just like, yeah, Biddle Fund. Yeah. Stable coins get exposure to treasuries and therefore they're like, it's a really successful business model. But like, yeah, it's not the games that we have played and not like the euphoric future that I had envisioned even as recently as like 2 years ago. It's practical. It makes a ton of sense in retrospect, but it was not what I had foreseen.
I was going to say, the tough part about generating yields means very literally we need to actually like generate users paying fees to decentralized protocols. Yeah. And at a high level, that is just currently lacking in the industry. And pointing again to that point of like what CT actually has exposure to, even the most, you know, what is the thing that, you know, people in the trenches on chain are using and paying for is Pump Fun, and is once again a thing that no one has exposure to, which we'll also get into like in our topic later on talking about like Boop and these other platforms. But it gets to that same point of like, yeah, I like the reality is a lot of this, you know, decentralized protocol activity, people like actually paying fees to use these things, it's still small to TradFi. The reality is like most of the yield is it's getting people to hold dollars and like, hey, we can clip the yield on like treasuries on the back end, stuff like that.
The idea that the institutions are going to come and buy our bags has been this like perpetual motivating force in the crypto industry. Like, we are so early, the institutions are going to come, we're going to get so rich because we own the rails, we own the tokens before the institutions do. And this was the dominant narrative in 2017, when some of the, looking back at the tokens that I own based on that narrative, I was an insane person. Like, those, no institutions was going to come and buy those tokens. Those were just the temper.
Did
yeah, you know, Dentacoin, you know, AeonNet, like IOTA, like these, yeah. These, what, you know, in hindsight were just like casinos that people gambled on at the time, had a narrative of like, oh yeah, these are the future rails of the internet. And I think right now in this moment of time, the reason why there's despair on the timeline is like multifold, right? There is the rails that institutions are actually using are not ownable. They are not ownable by us, or it's Bitcoin. And so that Bitcoin's not going to give us that like 100x that we're looking for, or it's Tether, which is a private company. And then like the middle of the market, I think we've talked about this before, the middle of the market where like there's a lot of, you know, people's jobs and the tokens that, you know, represented the speculative gamble that existed in 2020 and 2021. People are now realizing that that's just not likely to be the infrastructure that supports the future of finance. And so we are creating this stablecoin Bitcoin barbell with a meme coin kicker for those who want to speculate on the meme coins. And then the things in the middle, which represents like the livelihood of people who work in crypto, is just hollowed out. You add all those things together, I feel like that's how you get all the despair that we feel.
No, I mean, I totally agree. I think like it just is, it feels like we're kind of at a point where it's hard to see what's going to change that in the short term. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be interesting to see just how despairy we can get.
Okay, so speaking of how despairy we can get, you guys ready to dive into the movement drama? Because I've got a pretty robust set of notes, ChatGPT notes. So let me run through the facts of the details and we can unpack it together as a group. Okay, so November 27th, 2024 is when Rentec, which is a shell entity, asked the Movement Foundation to loan it 5% of all MOVE tokens. The general counsel of Movement called these terms possibly the worst agreement I've ever seen. Later, a tweaked version of that agreement still lets Web3port, a different entity, via Rentec, borrow the 66 million MOVE tokens and also liquidate these tokens if and once the FTV of the MOVE token hits $5 billion FTV. The signing of this agreement happens one day before the token goes live. Then later, December 9th through 10th, MOVE lists on Binance, wallets connected to Web3 port, which is the market maker, unloads the full $66 million in under 24 hours, pocketing $38 million, crushing the price. And then Binance later banned this offending market maker, which is the news that kind of rippled around the industry that everyone's like, yo, that's not normal. Like, what's going on over there? They flagged, of course, a market maker misconduct. And now Movement starts an internal review in this March to understand like what's going on. As a result, with the $38 million that was confiscated by Binance handed back over to the Movement Foundation, they announced a $38 million UST buyback to repurchase the dump tokens, and they have cut ties with Web3 Port, the market maker. So this is to sum up all of the reasons why people are calling this nefarious behavior. Rentech, this mysterious entity, appeared on both sides of the contract. So once as Web3 Port's subsidiary and once again as Movement Foundation's agent. So they are basically on both sides of the contract. They are negotiating and they're also the client. So the same people get to dictate the terms, the lending terms and the trading strategy. So they said, okay, you lend us 5 million tokens and we get to dump them at a $5 billion FTV market cap. So the same entities setting the terms. The perverse incentives are already in there. The idea that you get to dump 50% of the tokens if the token hits $5 billion is just a contractually obligated pump and dump scheme. There's no lockup. The $66 million tokens were immediately liquid. And despite the council's red flags, the deal still got passed through governance and was still somehow signed. So where do things stand now? There's an independent audit still in progress. Binance and reportedly U.S. regulators are gathering info. The foundation is, like I said, buying back the MOVE token on the open market to recover the $38 million, inject it back into the chart. And then also Rushi Manch, the CEO of Movement, has been suspended and the board is considering additional governance reforms. So I think this is really the sum of this is like we all as an industry knew that there were these boogeyman market maker deals out there, but no one had really ever seen it so explicitly and put into actual real contracts. And then those contracts were ended up being circulated. And there's extra weirdness about the relationship between the market maker and the foundation that I think is like the unique thing that allowed this to kind of explode onto the scene. But overall, now people are understanding that like this has become productized and structurally systemic across the industry. And we have seen this so many times, but now we have evidence of it. And now it's just got a little bit too real for people. And that's why people are reacting the way that they are reacting on Twitter. I'll just throw this to Bread. Bread, what are your thoughts? What are your reflections? What are you thinking?
I don't know if you saw it on the timeline, but there was some people from within the Movement team, like I think it was the DevRel person specifically, coming forward and giving like a gut-wrenching post-op of like, guys, I was blindsided by this too. It fucking sucks to have like tried to build all this stuff, get the encouragement of builders and like build up this ecosystem. And then like people are calling me dumb because I wasn't aware of it. So like one element of it is like feeling sympathetic for genuine people that are caught up in this stuff because they just weren't made aware of it. The other is there's a shit ton of hashes that were put on the timeline over the last like week of like things to be revealed later that I'm excited to see, several from like Torgrill, who works at Fluent now. I think Kobe put out one on a Movement post a couple of weeks ago. So
he revealed those.
Did he? What was it?
Yeah.
Can we talk about this mechanism? What does it mean to put a hash on a tweet or publish it on the internet? Like, why are people doing that and what's behind that hash?
Yeah, it's almost like a predictive thing, right? So you can just go to like any SHA-256 generator, put in any amount of text. That text will give you a hash string. And you just post that string. The ability to like brute force reverse engineer what that actually represents in like readable text is basically impossible. So people are posting things to say like, I know something about this, or I'm predicting something and I want to have proof that I can predict this. They post it on the timeline. And then after the point where it's no longer impactful either to the markets or the prediction has come true or whatever, they will go back and say like, this string of text is what reveals or what that hash translates to. So
they're just claiming that they know something. It's like a clout thing. It's like I'm claiming that I know something without actually revealing it, because if I'm right and it moves the market, or if I'm wrong and it moves the market, then that has consequences. But if I just hide this for now, it doesn't move the market, but I get to claim clout at a future date. Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. So like, if maybe if you have further damning evidence, but you're not sure of it and like you want to claim it, or it will have market impacts that you just don't want to impose until after it's revealed by someone else. You don't want to be the person that says it. It just gives you that ability to do that and yeah, show that you had insider information and or were onto something before other people were.
Okay. And then, John, you said that Kobe revealed his hash. He revealed what it said. Maybe walk us through that.
I don't remember the exact wording of it, but yeah, he posted it a couple weeks ago and then he revealed it in the last few days or so. It was just saying, I think the prediction was that Rushi would be removed within the next 28 days for like fraud or misconduct or something like that. And he revealed it in the past week, which was, he was correct.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah, I know the other main culprit was, like, again, Torgo working at Fluent. He's like, he has gone publicly after Movement a lot, and they throw him out at each other and basically just said, I had a bunch of stuff in my DMs I'm not willing to reveal, but he's just posting a bunch of hashes that, you know, maybe will be the reveal of whatever those DMs are. I'm not an investor myself. I don't have a lot of seed deals anywhere, but like the general thing was that people recognized early on that there's maybe some of this going on, but they saw it was a money-making opportunity anyways, and they went forward for that reason. So, you know, it's just a lot of questions around, you know, how much is that worth to people, right? Like, are they willing to jeopardize or give up on some of their values if they think something is wrong, if it comes with a couple dollars? You know, how prolific that was, or like the amount invested under those pretenses, I don't know. But I have heard that just, you know, through the grapevine. So commentary on the space.
Yeah, the interpretation of like, or evolution of Rushi the character, I think is also super relevant here, because like Rushi was one way at the very beginning, and he grew into the Rushi that we know today or have seen on Twitter today. And that was a character arc. That was a development arc that I think everyone in the industry kind of watched in real time. He's one of those like very, he attracts attention. He attracts a lot of attention. He does bold things. Those bold things attract more attention. And I think he kind of like leaned into those things over time to kind of create, in addition to all the things that the leadership things that he did behind the scenes, that was the, like cult of personality that was Rushi on the timeline.
One thing off of Brett's comment that I'll say, I mean, this is definitely not a rule for everyone, but I do think people do sometimes overestimate how much investors know on these kinds of things. I mean, we weren't investors in Movement. We looked at it and we decided not to. But I mean, the reason that we decided not to, and is what my sense is most investors like at most know on this kind of thing, is like, the vibe seemed off. Like, it didn't seem that serious. Investors, at least to my knowledge, none of them knew that like these were the explicit contracts that were going on. I mean, very literally, investors are also like trying to be dumped on in this case. Like, they were trying to use these high markups, for example, to like literally raise from investors at high FDVs after the fact. And like, they were literally selling. Like, the investors, you know, the early VCs and whatever, like, weren't cashing out at these prices. They were locked up and they were trying to sell to other VCs on the premise that, you know, oh, this is a $10 billion token and you're buying it at an 80% discount. What a great deal. But, you know, it's a fake price. Varying degrees of that. I mean, there certainly were some investors that like knew some stuff, at least based on what was tweeted out. But like, I do think that a lot of people do overestimate how much most of the investors in this probably knew. Most people did not see these agreements. Like, these are not normal market making agreements. Like, this is just crime. Like, people do like a lot of people, for the most part.
A lot of people who invest in something like this, like, especially if you're even funds, if you're not like leading around or something. And my experience on the other side of it, like, you write a check and every once in a while you send a Telegram message and you're like, hey, how are things going? You want to do a 30-minute call, and you do it and then you move on. Like, it's pretty rare that these funds are like doing serious due diligence into the financials and things like that. I know that changes as you raise more and more money, but then even in those cases, like, it kind of comes at like the goodwill of the founder in a lot of ways, and so even then you could very easily be lied to.
There's a different level of work and diligence expected of the lead funds and like most of the other people who are investing in this, and that's also something for people to realize, is that it's fair to have a different view on those different parts for these different deals. Most investors are like, you're not going through all the financials of the company and like figuring out all these details and asking for all the docs. Like, you just can't do that, particularly as a smaller investor.
I think Fallout it also shows some funny stories around, or like, so just some of the world of like investing when you're not leading around and you're just like, oh, this XYZ company is leading the round. Like, sure, I'll throw in money. I don't really care.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I was just going to say, it has echoes of the Eclipse fallout. I think it was whenever Neil was removed. And everyone after the fact, the funds came forward like, hey, we knew about this. Hey, we didn't know about this. And everyone's like, well, if you knew about it, why the hell didn't you tell everyone about like these
right.
things going on in the background that were material to like the actual effect of the project? So it's like impacts to the individual funds and like the trust that you build up and whether or not you do release some of this stuff, because some of it is hearsay, some of it like you actually do have the actual understanding of. So without having that first source, as long as it's not coming from the source, like you can't speak on a lot of these things, even if you are hearing rumors, because it can materially damage something. And if you're wrong and you're seen as someone doing that stuff and you got it wrong, like the fallout of that is almost as worse as the other side of it.
Yeah, broadly on that one too, I would say the same thing. I would say just as a broad rule, most people overassume how much people do going into that. And especially for this movement one, I do have a lot of respect for people who publicly with a public profile were tweeting stuff out going into this. People like Tool who were like knew or saw things that were off and were just like putting their name on it and saying like, yeah, this is a problem.
Yeah.
Because yeah, I am not a fan of when people clout farm after the fact and say like, oh yeah,
right.
of course I'm new.
Right.
I decided not to tell anyone. Like I'm just letting you know now. Like, but I knew. That's not helping anyone.
I have seen Togrel get like vicious about enough projects and then be proven right to the point of like the next time Togrel gets vicious about something, I'm like, oh, don't go there, don't touch that. He has been a pretty consistent like source of information, at least on stuff like this. I think one of the reasons why this just escalated to be as big as it was because like Movement was the only move based layer 2 that I'm aware of, and so you have Aptos and one of the Sui, say one of the other
Sui.
Ones. There's Sui. So Aptos, Sui, Move. It was those three. They were going after the Move programming language. Move was the only one doing it as a layer 2. And so there was this all of this like free real estate that Rushi was able to capture. The Movement ecosystem was able to capture. Like, okay, well, if we believe in layer 2s and if you believe in the Move programming language, like that's the Movement project. You don't have to think about it any further. I think that's the only Move layer 2 that I know of. Are there anyone? John, you're the layer 2 expert. Do you know of any other Move layer 2s? Is this now just
know.
An open field now?
I think so.
You get me curious. I'm going to go look now.
Yeah. I mean, is there a ton of, you know, are there just like a bunch of devs chomping at the bit? Like, oh, I really want to build on a Move-based platform, but it has to be secured by Ethereum. Like, what we have now right now is just not good enough. I think the Venn diagram of those people, it's not a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. It is pretty incredible that the Move FTV valuation is still at $1.6 billion valuation right now. I mean, it's coming down.
There's no sellers, right? Like who actually owns tokens that can sell them right now?
Mm.
That isn't like the Move Foundation. There's like some guys on Twitter who airdrop farmed and have like $50 worth of Move and say like G Move every morning. But otherwise, I don't think there's really any sellers on the open market.
Well, then where's all the volume coming from? Because there is volume.
I mean, David, we just talked about their illegal market making deals.
Imagine a world where your day-to-day banking runs on a blockchain. That's exactly what Mantle is building, powered by a $4 billion treasury and poised to become the largest sustainable on-chain financial hub. As part of their 2025 expansion, Mantle is introducing three new core innovation pillars that bridge traditional finance with decentralized technology. First is their Enhanced Index Fund, aiming for $1 billion in AUM by Q1. It provides optimized exposure to Bitcoin, ETH, Solana, and USD, complete with built-in yield opportunities. Next, Mantle Banking promises to revolutionize global value transfer through seamless blockchain-powered banking services, bridging crypto into your daily life. Finally, Mantle X blends AI with DeFi to deliver an intelligent, user-friendly experience for everyone. And the best part is that this is all in addition to their already launched products like Mantle Network, METH, and FBTC. Ready to step into the future of finance? Follow Mantle on X at Mantle_official and join the on-chain revolution today. In the wild west of DeFi, stability and innovation are everything, which is why you should check out Frax Finance, the protocol while revolutionizing stablecoins, DeFi, and Rolex. The core of Frax Finance is Frax USD, which is backed by BlackRock's institutional Biddle Fund. Frax designed Frax USD for best-in-class yields across DeFi, T-bills, and carry trade returns all in one. Just head to frax.com, then stake it to earn some of the best yields in DeFi. Want even more? Bridge your Frax USD over to the Fraxtl Layer 2 for the same yield plus Fraxtl points, and explore Fraxtl's diverse Layer 2 ecosystem with protocols like Curve, Convex, and more, all rewarding early adopters. Frax isn't just a protocol. It's a digital nation powered by the FXS token and governed by its global community. Acquire FXS through frax.com or your go-to DEX, stake it, and help shape Frax Nation's future. Ready to join the forefront of DeFi? Visit frax.com now to start earning with Frax USD and staked Frax USD. And for Bankless listeners, you can use frax.com/r/bankless when bridging to Fraxtl for exclusive Fraxtl perks and boosted rewards. Have you ever imagined Bitcoin and Ethereum truly working as one, unlocking the full potential of Bitcoin, DeFi, and more? Meet Hemi, a groundbreaking modular network designed precisely for that vision. Co-founded by early Bitcoin core dev, Jeff Garzik. Unlike other layer twos that treat Bitcoin and Ethereum as separate silos, Hemi connects these giants into a single powerful super network. With Hemi, users gain unprecedented asset portability and possibilities, combining Bitcoin security and value with Ethereum's versatility. Hemi's unique innovation, the Hemi Virtual Machine, integrates a fully indexed Bitcoin node directly into an EVM, enabling dApps that seamlessly interact with both networks. And with Hemi's proof of proof, or POP consensus, users benefit from truly decentralized, censorship-resistant, Bitcoin-level security. Since its recent mainnet launch, Hemi has rapidly ascended the ranks as one of the top Bitcoin chains. With a thriving global community and robust ecosystem support, Hemi isn't just building a network, it's shaping the future of Web3, DeFi, and beyond. Visit hemi.xyz/bankless to learn more, discover ways to interact, participate in the leaderboard program, and be part of the community that's uniting Bitcoin and Ethereum. Okay, we're ready to move on to Boop.fun. Andy, I think your help on this one because I'm actually unaware of what was going on. Maybe you can walk us through the Boop.fun drama.
Yeah, I would say that it really hasn't been a ton of drama. It's mostly just, I think, like kind of interesting. Brett and I have actually been talking about it a good amount in DMs over the last week since it came out. But Boop is a pump fun competitor, a meme coin launchpad. They just have some what I think are like pretty interesting tokenomics. Whether or not they're perfect or, you know, are going to work in the long run, who knows? But essentially, like, probably the first part of it that was interesting and garnered a lot of conversation is they had like a really big airdrop for people based on their Kaido. Or is it pronounced Kaido or Kaido?
Kaido.
All right, yeah. Kaido. Based on their Kaido scores for like meme coin stuff. And in order to claim your airdrop, you had to launch a meme coin like linked to your Twitter on the platform. And so that like
you had to write a tweet, you had to tweet a tweet that linked to your meme coin.
You didn't have to tweet about it.
Okay.
But you had to, they basically had like two options of how you can launch, and one is on the platform and one is via tweet. Yep. But you had to create a meme coin that then like on the platform it says, you know, Andy8052 made this meme coin. And so there was just a lot of conversation around that of like, this is kind of a pretty big airdrop, but I don't want to make a meme coin. What should I do? And like, I think Brad could probably add more color here on this part than I can, because I was just like, yeah, I'm going to do it. Who cares? I'm just going to make a meme coin that says.
I think your brand is very well suited for that.
Yeah. But Brad had a bit more of a.
Yeah, I painted myself in the corner is what you're trying to say. Is I fucking, I posted on it. It's like, okay, so game theory, smart, right? So like he said, the tokenomics or the airdrop itself targeted Kaido specifically because they worked with them. And it wasn't just like Mindshare. So it was like the higher you were with Mindshare up to your tier that you were able to get into for an airdrop, tier one, like people that were strong Mindshare, but also tweeted specifically about meme coins and trading and stuff like those type of accounts. They were tier one. They were getting airdrops at present day value at like $200, $250,000, right? The thing is, it has to vest for 30 days. If the coin that you launch does not do anything, right? You launch it, it has to bond, it has to hit 5, 10, 15, and then $20 million market cap in order to get like a fully unlocked. And like, so then that means you're actually capturing $250,000-ish. Tier two, tier three, whatever. I think Andy and I are both tier three. So our range was at present day value, like, I was like $80,000, $90,000 roughly. So like decent airdrop, right? So
it's pretty damn good.
Yeah, I saw that, but like not knowing, I don't meme coin, I don't trench. It's like, I'm not going to tweet about this thing. Like the chance of me getting an unlock today is zero. The chance of me getting an unlock in 30 days, it's worth anything. just above zero, but still really close to zero. So I tweeted that out. I was like, yeah, you know what? I'm over it. I'm not going to post it. Right. Easy. But then I started breaking down the actual tokenomics of it. And, you know, we alluded earlier about getting ownership of these protocols, and you see the flywheel extended to the game theory that the platform actually has. So it's led by Dingling. Dingling's kind of a prolific. He was prolific in the NFT space. Now we're starting to learn that he was actually founder of, or one of the founding teams of PancakeSwap, and worked with CZ specifically on Binance. So like that's where he's sourced a lot of his funds from, and we're learning. Explains a lot of his lore. So he was on the founding team. And the tokenomics associated to it is, if you have Boop, which is the platform token, and you were to stake Boop, you get lifetime 1% or pro rata 1% of all trading fees, both pre-bond and post-bond, of all the meme coins on the platform. Every time a token bonds and goes from the launchpad to just the open Radium pool, it takes 5% of the supply and gives it again pro rata to the people that have Boop staked on the platform. So if you have the platform token and you stake the platform token, you basically just get an index exposure on all tokens that are launched from the platform in perpetuity, right? And you can claim those separately and do a bunch of stuff. So I was like, looking at that stuff, I was like, okay, the flywheel is kind of here. Like, I can kind of see why people would want to accumulate this thing. There's a non-zero chance this thing's actually worth some money. I already tweeted that. I was like, I'm not launching this fucking thing. It's like, all right, I really want this. And like, do I want potentially, you know, five figures of exposure of the main token? I was like, I probably do. So it's like, so I had to come back and do a mea culpa of like, all right, guys, I lied. I'm launching one of these things. Don't buy it. So I launched it the next day. And then I saw like John had one on there, Danny had one. Like, it's like, okay, so I'm not the only one, but I fucked up because I posted about it beforehand instead of just like silently doing it in the background, and just like accumulating tokens. But yeah, it's interesting. Volume's still not there. I'm generally not bullish on teams encroaching on Pump Fun. It's just such an established platform, but the tokenomics itself had me interested enough that I went over and launched one.
Yeah, Brett's a nice guy. He was hesitant. I had absolutely zero moral qualms. I immediately went and tried to launch on the only reason it took me a few hours is because the website wasn't working.
the president of the United States has launched a meme coin. I will.
Yeah. Yeah. I had absolutely no problem with it. It was kind of funny. Like, I saw a bunch of people who were going through the same thought process that you were going through. The first one that I saw was, I don't remember the guy's name. It's like Bold Leonidas, whatever the one that Kobe replied to, who had like a gigantic one. And Kobe replied to him because the guy was saying like, oh, I'm not going to do it. And he was like, Kobe was replying to him like, what are you talking about? Just launch the thing and like just say, hey, guys, I'm not going to talk about this thing ever again. Just like assume it's going to go to zero. Like, you're literally going to lose your money. I'm just like clicking this button so that I can claim like a life-changing airdrop.
Well, that turned into copypasta that people started.
Yeah, yeah. What I put in my token. It's like I called it a scam, and then I like copy-pasted like Kobe's tweet into the thing and like put it in there of like, you're literally going to lose all your money. Like, to me, it was funny that like people like would have a hesitation of that, because like, what are you doing at this point? Is you're literally just launching a like fairly launched, you know, safe token that you're just openly telling to people like, hey, like there's no value to this thing, like whatever, just like if you want to buy it, like go ahead, buy it, but like you literally should not buy it. Like, you're literally just going to lose your money at this point. This is like the most fairly launched, straightforward, like you're just launching a token. Like, this is just technology. Like, there's nothing extractive or problematic about this. Like, you should be willing to launch this token with like absolutely no moral qualms in my mind, at least. Like, I get why people are hesitant at first. Like, you are like, you know, putting it next to your profile or whatever, but like, you literally just say like, hey, like don't buy this thing. Like, I'm never going to talk about this thing.
I realized it was like arm's reach from the Coinit stuff that Jesse was trying to do. Cause like I was looking at this stuff, and I think ERC-20 and like, it's just an ERC-20. And I was imbuing a bunch of like negative sentiment from like the extractors who might be in the meme coin, who might do the pump and dump stuff, into a neutral standard. Like, it's literally just a token. It's just a whatever. Okay. And I was seeing this, and after sleeping on it the next morning and like actually wanting something else, we're like, yeah, what am I doing? Like, why do I care so much? It's literally just like a thing. I did friend tech. I was deep in the friend tech trenches. Same shit, right? Yeah. Like, I was there. I created a chat. I was, you know, people were buying my stuff, and like, you know, you do the dance, and it's like, I had no moral qualms about that after the fact. Like, I feel good, and like knowing I participated in that in good faith. So as long as you're not like misleading people and like saying like, oh, this thing, I'm gonna pump this thing to Valhalla, you're gonna make a bunch of money off me, keep buying my shit. Like, as long as you're not doing some of that, then yeah, man, just participate. Mm-hmm.
I think the thing that we're all sensing from crypto Twitter is that crypto Twitter is hypersensitive to hypocrisy. And so, like, if I had gone and launched that token, I think I would have been absolutely just, like, shredded by the average like, trenchman of crypto Twitter, just because, like, my past relationship with meme coins, which, like, I've had this relationship with meme coins 2 years ago, 1 year ago, and that is not the same relationship that I have with meme coins today. And I would say that there has been like a more than marginal shift of just like once was complete rejection. And now it's been like, okay, that's rejecting meme coins is not the right strategy. I should be more accepting of meme coins. It's not the biggest shift. And even that shift has triggered so many people of like, David is duplicitous. He's a hypocrite. He only likes meme coins when they're on Ethereum, like all this kind of stuff. And so like marginal changes in your stance becomes like just targets of crypto Twitter, just you'll get shredded there. And so like, Brett, yeah, you painted yourself into the corner. You said you were going to do something, but hey, you know, as soon as a $90,000 airdrop comes up, like all of a sudden you're not going to do that thing anymore. Like that's not no longer what you believe. And so I think it's really the hypocrisy that crypto Twitter will absolutely just like tear you apart for.
Yeah. That's why I had to post on it. Cause like I made that claim of like, I'm not doing this. And I was like, man, if people come and like, I even had someone like the second I did it before I had posted like, all right, fuck it. I gave in. Like, this is why I gave in all this stuff. I had people coming back to my original post and just like laughing at it. Like, LOL, you gave in. I was like, yeah, I know. Like, mea culpa. Sorry guys. Like I'm an idiot. I'm diving back in. If I had not done that, I just would have been in silence.
I feel like part of that that's like frustrating for me with crypto Twitter is like, there's like a fine line between being a hypocrite and then like changing your mind with more information. And that nuance is basically always completely lost on crypto Twitter. And so it's like, if you ever change your mind about something, you're a coward. You have like no backbone versus like, I feel like that's something that should actually be praised, that you like are able to have an opinion and then continue to evaluate that thing and change your mind. I think it's one of the more frustrating parts of crypto Twitter for me.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of connotation there about like the motivations for why minds are changed and the context in which minds are changed. And so like I became like more into the idea of meme coins downstream of Clanker, discovery of Clanker. And Clanker I thought was cool because it was this bot that minted a token for you in this very easy UX of just you would add it on Farcaster. And I thought that was interesting. And then downstream of that, a token would be created. And like, I guess that's a meme coin, but that was like my first public like foray into memery. And then like the Solana people, it's like, oh, as soon as meme coins are on Base, like David's happy.
Yeah, more highbrow stuff.
Yeah, it's more highbrow meme coins. Yeah, rather than just like the 4chan aesthetic of Pump Vun versus the whatever the aesthetic is of Farcaster. I find the aesthetic of Farcaster more like palatable for me personally. That's more my speed. And so that makes sense for me when I find meme coins on this platform more enticing and tweetable about. But then all of the Solana people is like, no, David didn't change his mind. He just wants to pump his Ethereum bags. And so there is like tribal relevancy to like the nature of how and why minds get changed.
I did a mint on Twitter through BankerBot this week. You could similar setup just on Twitter. And so I was able to just tweet at something and it minted some NFTs for me, which is pretty fun.
Morality part or whatever we want to call it, the boop stuff side. Should we hit on the business side of it a little bit? Because this one is an interesting one to me. I'm curious, Brad, because I think you've looked at the numbers a little bit more than me. Mm-hmm. But a lot of this, I mean, relates to, I would say, like higher level even than boop. It's like pump fun and like how strong is their moat and being able to disrupt that. Because I have been surprised, like if you look at the numbers, Pump Fun is still just printing money.
It's ungodly. Like, they have like not fallen off nearly, a day, I think.
Yeah, they have not fallen off nearly as much as you like would have expected for how much it feels like, oh, the meme coin hype is past. They're still running at like a $600 million plus annualized run rate right now. Most of that coming from their launch pad. I think it's about like 13% of it is coming from their the AMM pump swap that they launched at the end of June to basically just compete and kind of kick out where Radium was. But right now, like Pump Fun is keeping all of that, obviously. Like that's just going to the company and they're just like sending just gigantic clips of SOL over to Kraken, basically. And I assume that they are cashing that out. Like good for them. They built a great product. They're making a bunch of money. And now it's time to like, okay, like are people going to disrupt this? Like the analogy that I'd seen people drawing, which I think is like a reasonably representative one, is like, and this would be kind of, I would guess, the bear case for Pump Fun, if you want to call it this, I guess, in hindsight, of like, it looks a little bit like OpenSea. Of, you know, OpenSea had this just gigantic run for a while during NFT Mania where, I mean, they were just absolutely printing money. They were keeping
valued at $10 billion or something at the top.
I don't remember what the number was, but they were, I mean, just tons of money that they were taking out.
I think it was higher than $10
billion. Wow.
Yeah. Like there was a period where they were, I mean, they were just printing money. And I mean, God knows how many millions they were making at the time. I don't remember what the exact numbers were. But same thing of like, they kept all of it. They didn't feel pressured into launching a token. And then over time they lost their the market fell away. Competitors chipped away at them. Blur and all these other ones came in. And so Pump Fund is kind of like at this position now where they have a dominant market position. They're printing money on this big thing still. And this is where Boop is coming in of like, I mean, there's nothing like that innovative in my mind to what they're doing versus Pump. The very simple pitch that they have to people is like, hey, we're going to give you the money back. Like, we have a token. And, you know, you can get this token and this is going to have a lot of fees going to it because it's one of the few things in crypto that like people actually pay for to that conversation that we were having earlier. There's like, there's actually real money that'll go to the token. And then we'll use this to incentivize people. And this is what I saw some of your tweets were I think, to remember the exact numbers, I had it of like, they give out like 1 million Boop a day. Was it 10% goes to the graduating token launchers, 90% goes to the graduating token holders. So they were explicitly, it's like using the token to explicitly incentivize creators and holders in a way that like Pump Fund is not doing right now. And so the question becomes like, is this the edge that like, you know, is able to push someone over the top and kind of like chip away into Pump's lead? Like, does Pump feel the pressure on them now to, you know, do they need to launch a token? Do they need to start using incentives, stuff like that going forward? Because we've seen different analogies in this crypto. I mean, like a different one, but somewhat similar, was like Uniswap. Obviously, like when Sushi launched their token and they started to try to incentivize it, pull away, like Uni did cave into the pressure. They launched a token. It's created a lot of problems in hindsight between equity and the token and all that, a lot of complexity, but like they won the battle by doing so very handily. You know, they won that market. And so that's the main thing I'm interested to see here is basically how does Pump respond to this stuff going forward? Do they feel like they need a token that they're going to need to incentivize people? Like, do they see a real risk here going forward? Or do they just try to do some other form of like creator monetization sharing where like, oh yeah, a portion of new launches are going to go back to creators because they've sort of hinted at some of the stuff like this. I'm curious your guys' takes on this, especially Brad, like having looked more at the numbers of this, kind of like what's going through it.
Yeah, so I actually put a post out trying to like, I've been trying to work with some people building Dune dashboards to try to track some of it because it's a little opaque right now. And whenever I did that, Dingling actually sent me a message that like said, hey, some of your numbers are actually need to be refined because like they haven't released all the stuff. So we're just digging on chain to figure it out. And the 24-hour stats that he showed me at the time was fees earned by Boop stakers. So this is 24-hour numbers. Was 11,500 SOL, so 1.7 million. Trading volume of all colts created was 356 million. There were 440 colts graduated and 21,000 total colts created over that time period. So that means if this was over 24-hour period, 440 colts. That means 1 million Boop, which I think it was at times was between like $150,000 and $300,000, depending on the price of Boop, was going out to people daily, split amongst those 440 colts graduated. So that's 10% of that. What is that? $35,000 across 440 different people. I know, but from talking to the ecosystem, there are people who are specifically trying to game this and to like automatically launch and bond tokens so that they can eat up or saturate the bonded token market and just eat up the portion of that 1 million Boop. How successful it is, I think most of the people that I talked to just saw it wasn't a profitable endeavor. And I had talked to like several people who were working on this. So I don't think it's necessarily being farmed at least too heavily. But I agree with you. Imran, the founder of Alliance DAO, which is where Pump Fund came out of, right? So you presume that he's a investor inside of Pump Fund. He had mentioned kind of alluding to the Sushi Swap stuff after this had come out. He's like, hey, yeah, you know, whenever the pressure is felt, you know, and people start or have to launch tokens, all this stuff. So everyone's like, oh, Pump Fund token coming. Like, is this alluding to a future for us? So everyone's getting a little excited about that. But yeah, like all of the incentives that you just pointed out, even like if that's enough to get people incentivized to launch their token, to just simply move their token launch from Pump to Boop, like that's what that marketing budget is for, right? That daily drop to try to get people over. I haven't seen it pulling a ton over based on just like the dashboards and stuff that we're tracking. If 440 graduations in a 24 hours, if that's actually the true 24-hour numbers, which I'm hoping it is, that's pretty good. But you know, it's just a really sticky thing. I think we're gonna have to watch it for over a couple of weeks to see if any meaningful amount actually comes over. But I think the structure is there to incentivize people. It's just about educating the market and changing behavioral patterns, which is always the tough part.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me because, like, unlike OpenSea, which we were kind of comparing it to, like, the life cycle of the time in which people use Pump Fun is, like, so minimal and it's so abstracted away. Like, as someone who trades meme coins and low-cap meme coins, I don't ever go to Pump Fun's website. Like, whether you launch your meme coin on Boop or Pump Fun or Bonk Fun, whatever, like, I still see it on Axiom or any of these other tools that you trade with, regardless. And so it's like, you're not getting, as a, you know, meme coin creator, some structural advantage of, you know, publicity by launching on Pump Fun. And so, like, it makes it even more confusing why people still do it when you're literally getting paid to do it elsewhere. And so that would be the one thing that I'm curious to see if over time people's, you know, patterns can change there. But I think the big thing too with it is just most of the meme coins that hit escape velocity or have like meaningful traction are significantly more premeditated than the average Pump Fun launch. And maybe there is more like tooling or like structural reasons as to why those are being launched on Pump Fun because of sniping and bundling tokens and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally just industrial scale farming around and like a complex built around Pump Fun. It's like it's been printing so much money for so long. Like you have entire teams operating around the specific mechanics that are Pump Fun. So it's just, you know, once you have that stuff in place, the cost to move is just not really worth it unless they actually have exposure to Boop. We saw the same thing with Frentech, right? Frentech was like, whenever it came around, it was expensive as shit, 10% fees both ways. Like it was gouging people, racked up $50 million in fees, and everyone spun up a copycat protocol. It's like, oh guys, come over here, it's cheaper fees, we have a token, like all this stuff, and no one moved because just like first mover has such a crazy advantage in this space, or can, whenever you're perceived as the clone. Like there's just some psychological component to that rarely plays out. It doesn't, like there are instances where it works out, but
John. I'd say no one moved in that circumstance, but I would say people moved and that Frentech sort of just died and everyone left, which slightly skews the example. There wasn't like a market to take from, versus with Pump, they clearly just still have a ton of users who have stuck around for an extended period of time. Like they have a ton of people who are still just like launching or trading tokens. So there is a large sustainable market, or at least somewhat more sustainable than Frentech, that is around to be competed away at. Versus Frentech, there wasn't just like a lot left to pull away.
Yeah, I kind of feel like we'll need to see like whatever would potentially unseat Pump Fun more seriously. I feel like it would need to be something that, you know, no disrespect to Boop, but I guess a little bit, even if I say that, like is a little bit better. like I don't think something that is just as good as Pump Fun with like some novel token mechanics is going to be enough. Like when I think about like the OpenSea and Blur kind of situation of things, if you were trading NFTs at the time, there were other platforms that came out that tried to unseat OpenSea as well and do similar things.
Who was also like launched by Dingling. Yeah.
And they just weren't good enough. And then you had Blur come around where it was like, it was actually better. It was a better platform to use. And so I think that will really be the needle mover, is if someone, and I don't know what better means here. If I did, I wouldn't be having this conversation. I'd be building it. But I think that'll really be what's required to seriously unseat Pump Fun.
Every single token launcher has come to the table marketing with, we return fees to the traders, we return fees to the token holders. And so, I mean, everyone has identified that is like the attempt, but that has not worked. Like Flaunch has tried this. It had their week of success in the Ethereum community. Clanker was not like this and then pivoted to returning fees to users. Like Boop is now doing this as well. Pump Fun has also moved in that direction too, as well. And so they have kind of like front run this, and they have taken a reduced rake on when the tokens graduate. And so the fees, the take rate from Pump Fun has actually come down because I think that they are front running this. But I think, you know, the meme coin vertical, the meme coin industry, is proved to be completely sustainable. It's going to be, I think everyone understands that this is here. is a part of crypto. It's a part of what makes this industry. And so now this is not like the OpenSea of 2021. This is now trying to compete with Coinbase in 2013. I think we are just going to see continual evolution and attempts at dethroning Pump Fund just because it has proven to be such a sustainable cash cow. And so I think you could probably count on a meme coin launchpad launching once a quarter for now into, you know, the end of time.
Oh, for sure. And yeah, I think like I'd be really interested to see someone try to come in and disrupt things in a way that's more like a complete trading experience or something that feels more like Axiom or these different things, or like trying to come at it from a different angle than just like, we also have a web page where you can input a couple fields and press launch a token.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think that stuff around trying to not come at it from the one place that everyone has tried to, of lower fees, give back to the community, is probably going to be what's required for something like super interesting to come out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And alongside that fee reduction, David, that you mentioned, which was like with the pump swap, I remember they did at that time to say they tweeted out, which I don't believe anything has happened yet, but I expect at some point they said it was coming soon. A percentage of protocol revenue will be shared with coin creators. So right. they do feel the pressure, which yeah. I mean, at minimum, I think this is just good. I mean, we are just reducing the pressures of like a very large incumbent is printing a ton of money right now. This is a good force going forward at minimum of you're just going to be able to redistribute that value better, and they're going to be squeezed a little bit more to give money back more to traders and creators, which I think is generally a good thing. On that point, Andy, of like you probably need more of a real, just something that's totally different and better in some way, as opposed to just, you know, we have a token with incentives, we give you money back. The other thing I've mentioned to you guys, I'm guessing that I know your opinions on this, but I'm curious for Antifund that had they came out a couple days ago at some point. I'd seen they're trying to go in this direction of doing something like actually different. I mean, the very TLDR of it, for anyone who hadn't seen it, was basically they batch execution of like all of the trades and the bids on these things over an epoch where a creator can set whatever epoch length. So you could say like, hey, I'm launching a token. Epoch is 1 minute. So basically everyone who puts in a bid for that thing in that time, like all the whole batch like clears at the same price. So you get rid of snipers who like, oh, know the launch is coming and they put it in that millisecond and then they like the dump on you after. You get rid of sandwiching, stuff like that, which is good. And so this is a theoretically like much better mechanism. It gets rid of a lot of these problems. It was something that we talked a little bit about last week of like, but like, I don't know if that's like actually what users want. And I'd seen some tweets along this line with
Flaunch did this. Yeah. That you could open up a 30 minute, 1 hour long window. Everyone could get in at the fair price. And it's, you know, there's no sniping. It's so much more fair. But then as we talked about, like the marketing around that is just not nearly as viral as the incentive of like, oh, I am person number three to buy this. Let me share that link with my friend Andy. And then Andy passes it to his friend. I'm number four. Let me pass it to my friend Brad, who's number five. And so like, there's that like positive feedback loop crescendo of marketing around the tokens, and a fair launch just like yoinks that.
Yeah. And the most cynical version of that, I would say, is it was a tweet from Joe Xerox Osprey, for anyone who doesn't know him on Twitter. He said, unpopular opinion that I'm willing to change my mind on. Meme coin launchpad tokens would be way less successful in aggregate without sniping by sophisticated actors/cabals. Their incentives to propagate the meme is often a requirement for it to reach escape velocity, which is a very cynical, but like, that's unfortunately very cynical. Probably meaningfully correct statement.
Is it game of incentives, baby? That's what this whole space is about.
It's funny because I'm in a lot of, you know, degen trading chats and stuff, and there's kind of this like ongoing joke of like, oh, there's pretty good tooling and stuff to see if a coin is bundled and, you know, the supply is cornered and whatever. And it's just, it's, when you see that, it's the question of like, is this a good supply control or bad supply control? and it's like, when the supply control is good, that's an incredible, you want to be in the coins that are bundled. That are like bundled supply control cabals when they're not going to dump it on you. But when it's bad supply control and then it goes to, you know, $500,000 and all of a sudden it's at zero, that is not quite as fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the entire argument about the Brett coin on base. It's like, everyone's like, what the fuck is this meme? No one uses this. No one talks about this. But it's like, it's at $2 billion and it's the number one meme going over there. And it's like, because it was bundled out the gate. And they're like, but they're good bundlers. So therefore, they manipulated it in the right direction and we love them.
They manipulated it for us, for posterity. Yeah.
Uh-huh. I was going to say, this is that meme of like the two sides fighting. It's like our glorious supply control, like your wickered market manipulation.
Yeah. But yeah, the anti-fund thing, it's all just like the mid-curve take on what meme coins should be. Like that's, yeah. Unfortunately, it's just not gonna be successful. We talked about it last week or whenever that
was. I think that there is like an interesting version. Like, I think it's interesting for particularly like event-based meme coins where there's like a thing that happens and everyone wants to trade this thing that has now like captured attention. I feel like those have always kind of like existed in a weird kind of timeline next to more regular meme coins like Fartcoin and things that aren't tied to an event or a thing, because they're like, there is demand and you see it with coins being created and stuff for like Trump just said this funny word, let's make a coin for it, which like everyone who's buying that kind of knows that in a day or whatever it'll be dead, but it's fun to play that game of chicken. And I think those actually have like a much better case for something like the anti-fund, where it's like, launch this thing, you have 5 minutes, anyone who can get in, because like snipers are not going to be looking, like actually not having snipers on like the Trump word thing could mean that 24-hour trading of this coin is like way more fair and fun. And everyone kind of already knows that it's not going to $100 billion or whatever. There's like, that's just not really a part of the game. And so I could see it being more useful for things like that are maybe more ephemeral memes versus things that are like trying to be just like cults.
I still like binary markets, like Polymarket. Like as someone who rode the Bowdoin wave, I am more into like markets that actually have an outcome that I can make a decision on, versus like trying to like choose one of 75 coins that are loosely associated to the event that I'm trying to bet on, and then ultimately the market deciding to rug me even though I was directionally correct in the thing that I was buying. Like that. Yeah. So, you know, like one of the apps that we've been incubating that people are starting to play on the timeline, Noise, it kind of trying to get closer to this, right? Because like what you're ultimately trying to bet on with something like that is you're trying to bet on this thing gaining mind share or having an outcome that like getting attention, right? Like AI bots or whatever caught a huge wave. You could buy AIXBT, you could buy Zero Bro was kind of one. You had like 90,000 different like slot bots that came out, and you could have bought one of 75 of these tokens that were kind of associated with this sector that you thought was cool. And then they just be rugged like instantly because there's a lot of like countervailing forces in that, the vehicle that is a meme coin, right? You have people that bundle it, that just don't give a shit about the thing. They're trying to make money. And like, even though you're directionally correct in the thing that you want, even if it gains mind share, you can go to zero while everything goes to Valhalla, right? Because you just chose the wrong one of the thing. Kaido kind of is trying to get closer to this with their mindshare thing, because they have an algorithm that kind of prunes some of the noisiness of this stuff and allows you to bet that. And that's like what the Noise platform is trying to like build a protocol in the back end around. It's like, okay, if we can have this asset that actually does take the cumulative conversation around this thing and it can go up while everything else goes down, like that's appealing, and the market seems to be enjoying it. But it is a new asset, and like whether or not you can have someone that takes the other side of that trade, which is a problem that Polymarket has with a lot of these things, is the next question.
Those are cool, and I like, I remember David, you had the poster on this, I think, like orderly attention markets is like the basic idea of what people are trying to get at. My main like hesitation with these kind of things still is I think all of them, again, they make sense, and then my concern is, are they somewhat of the slightly mid curve in the way that anti-fun is of, yeah, like, yeah, but like they definitely make more sense for the thing that I'm trying to express. I haven't seen one that I'm like fully confident isn't just, but like it seems more fun if I just buy the meme coin, man.
Right,
just like all of the virality and everything that goes along with that, as opposed to, hey, we have like this very structured derivatives market, and like you can express this directional thing, that this view that you have. I'm like, that makes sense, but like maybe I just want to buy the meme coin for the guy. And that at least so far, I mean, that's what we've seen. It's like, I mean, those just have been bigger. But that is the really difficult thing that I think people are trying to balance, is like you're trying to make this like very structured and specific thing so that you could, you know, express exactly this directional bet that you have without it just falling into very directly, okay, you're just making a prediction market on an event or like a single oracle that's just like, yeah, it's just a prediction market at the end of the day. like trying to balance those things of like the memeability, the virality, the somewhat subjectivity of it, and having you express what you want, like that is really difficult to do.
Imagine verifying yourself without handing over personal data. No hacked databases, no unnecessary personal exposure for airdrops, and no AI bots ruining community governance. Meet Self, the on-chain identity verification protocol built for privacy and control. Self protocol uses zero-knowledge proofs to confirm your identity safely. Users prove key details like age or citizenship without revealing sensitive personal information. Self never stores your data. It only generates cryptographic proofs. Here's how it works in three steps. First, register and verify. Use the Self app to scan your biometric passport's RFID chip. Self verifies authenticity with zero knowledge proofs. Each passport creates one unique identity. Second, you can share proofs privately. Third-party apps request identity proofs, like confirming you're over 18. You can also link proofs securely to public wallets for airdrops or governance participation. And then last, secure verification. Apps validate your proofs instantly on-chain, like on Celo, or off-chain. Audited by ZK Security, the Self app is live on iOS and Play Store. Visit self.xyz and follow Self Protocol on X. Uniswap is your gateway to a more efficient DeFi experience. With Uniswap, swapping and bridging across 13 chains is simple, fast, and cost-effective, helping you move value wherever, whenever. Thanks to deep liquidity on the Uniswap protocol, you'll enjoy minimal price impact on every trade. And now Uniswap V4 takes it even further. Swappers benefit from gas savings on multi-hop swaps and ETH trading pairs, while liquidity providers can create new pools at 99% lower costs. The best part, you don't have to do anything extra. Each trade is automatically routed through Uniswap X, V2, V3, and V4, so you get the most efficient swap without even thinking about it. Whether you're swapping, sending, on-ramping, off-ramping, or bridging, Uniswap's web app and wallet gives you the tools to unlock DeFi's full potential on Ethereum, Base, Arbitrum, Unichain, and more. Use Uniswap's web app and wallet for a more efficient way to use DeFi.
All right, I think we're going to have to rename this podcast to the Weekly Meme Coin Discussion, because I think meme coins have been present in all three of these episodes. So let me pivot us out of meme coins into something on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, which is the Ethereum Pectra upgrade that will go live for us, for everyone here on the panel, in about 12 hours. So for listeners, it will have already gone live. So Pectra is live in the morning of May the 7th. There's a bunch of new EIPs that are going to go live, too many to really list off. And of course, some of them are just long tail. But the three I'll drive attention to is 7702, which means that all 0x wallets, all EOAs, to basically become smart contract enabled. They have smart contract wallet functionality. EIP 7691, that is expanding the blob capacity, doubling it from 3 to 6 as the target. And then the last one, 7251, is max effective balance. Validators can stake a range of ETH between 32 ETH to 2048 ETH rather than just a rigid 32 ETH. I think it's 7702, which is the kind of the big upgrade here. It's a huge UX upgrade for all wallets. And so really what this enables is all 0x addresses can just run this like one-off contract code, execute that code, and then revert back to being a vanilla EOA. That's what happens in the background, and this is what enables account extraction abilities for EOAs. The first like nice thing that comes with this is batched transactions, so we can remove the approve pop-up. You can tie together a series of 8 transactions, including the approve, and consolidate it into just a one-click experience. And this also removes secret area for failed transactions. And then you can also have sponsored paid token denominated gas. So that means that layer one apps can pay for their users' gas fees. It means gas fees can be paid in tokens, mainly stablecoins, but any token, but most likely stablecoins. And so these two things, I think, are just a huge UX upgrades for layer one user usage of Ethereum. And removing that approve button, I think no one really realized that the approve button was going to decimate billions of dollars of market cap from Ethereum. But I think we all kind of understand how that happened. John, let me throw this one to you as the researcher of the group. What do you see when you see Pectra?
I'll give the two sides of it. The first one is probably closer to my 60-40 honest take on it, is Pectra took a really, really, really long time to ship. There's a lot of fighting over what was going to go in it. Most of the stuff you probably didn't need in hindsight, and like some of it ends up being underwhelming. Like I think that's like this was not operationally the best fork that Ethereum has had. Like it took a long time to get this together. It was a pretty messy, kept getting delayed. A lot of problems there. That's I would say the sort of pessimistic, hey, this is what we need to improve going forward. And I think that those lessons have been learned from there. And I would say, so pivoting into the positive side of it is, one is I do think those lessons have been learned. And that is what you were seeing with EOF is dead for Fusaka effectively at this point. And it looks very likely that Fusaka is just going to be Pyrdos. Or like very possibly at minimum, that is like the, you know, that is the 99% focus of it. And they want to ship it faster. Like there is at least an attempt to get it shipped later this year, not even next year. That would be a super aggressive big change of, you know, hey, we realized in hindsight, like, man, like Petra took a really long time, bunch of shit got thrown in there, everyone fought over what to go in there. But like, hey, we all agree that Pyrdos is the super important thing. We should just do that and just ship this thing as fast as possible. So the lessons were learned, which I think is really good. And then the positive parts about Pectra are kind of what you said. And I would summarize it as, I think we talked about it last week, of basically, you know, the best way to summarize now what Ethereum's goals are is like the three-pronged scale the L1, scale blobs, improve UX. Pectra has 2 out of 3 to a very meaningful degree there. If this is going to scale blobs pretty meaningfully, and 7702 is going to be meaningfully important for UX, like having to sign multiple times, like for approve and then swap, like all this, it's just annoying. So hopefully the wallets like do really adopt this and improve the UX meaningfully. And this is like an actual improvement on more blobs. So I think there's a little bit of both. Like in hindsight, this was definitely not the best fork that you wanted. Like you would do things very differently with the benefit of hindsight if we went back, you know, 18 months or whatever it was from the last fork. But there is some good stuff in here, and there's a lot of lessons in here for the next work going forward. I don't remember the exact amount of months, but it was a long time. I can check exactly what it was. But yeah, it was a pretty long one.
I'll say blobs get scaled meaningfully on a percentage term, but not in a raw term.
Absolutely, yeah. We get three more blobs.
That's the other. Yeah, we're talking peanuts here. Like I've tweeted some of these numbers before. Like if you put these numbers next to like Celestia or EigenDA or any of these things, I mean, these are like many orders of magnitude apart. So 2x is great, but you're still like, you know, 1% of these other things.
Just for like reference for people who haven't seen the charts, like it's mostly like, what was it right now? Ethereum's pushing, what is it, like 15 kilobytes or ridiculous low number to megabytes that are being pushed on Celestia today. Celestia is like 1.33 getting
kilobytes
ready to
a second to megabytes a second.
Yeah, correct. Like you just view all this, it's bandwidth requirements, right? Like all these chains need to put their data somewhere. So you need to send data over the network and store it somewhere so someone can make it available. That means you need something that can receive that information, store it cheaply or, you know, relatively cheaply, and then make it available so that you can actually like reconstruct the state of the chain and like see if someone's lying or whatever, right? So like if you look at the raw numbers, it's kilobytes to megabytes. And even, you know, if you look down the road with Pyrdos and full dank sharding, all this stuff, right? Like even then, like the Ethereum state is I don't have it at the top of my head. I just know that like you're barely getting at what a lot of these LTA platforms are doing today. And that's 3 years from now, right? So it's like they're going to continue to scale. They're going to be orders of magnitude higher. Like if you think this industry is going to require more data, more throughput, more bandwidth, then Ethereum is just not going to be able to keep up, frankly. And like if it comes at the cost of all the storage on the nodes and then requires them to like jeopardize how valuable their actual blocks, like the call data side of the block space are, like I don't think that's a good trade-off. I don't like, especially when at will the posting patterns are for a lot of these chains that post to Ethereum, right? Like they just simply like they're never going to do it in a time of high fees because it doesn't impact their users. They can just avoid posting, wait, you know, I think Linnea told me that they straight up wait 30 minutes is the max they'll allow themselves right now to just like stop posting blobs because it doesn't impact their users. There's no real security concerns up until that 30 minute window. There's no social like repercussions to not posting blobs. They're just like, yeah, we just, you know, it saves us money. It saves our users money. It's a good business decision, which fair, like it is. And like, that's like, I will continue to expect these people to behave in this way because that is the rational thing to do as these actors. And I don't see it's as a great value accretive thing for Ethereum to fight on that vertical. One other thing, John, you may actually have numbers on this with the stake increase going from 32 to, was it 2052, something like that, right? I know there's some gossip overhead that actually comes with that, right? Having to maintain all these validators that have to communicate with each other. So like that is indirectly a performance increase of the network where it's a little leaner, right? With when you have all these large institutions that have to run 1,000 of these validators as opposed to just like one box that holds all the ETH. Do we have any idea of like what that overhead reduction is?
that's why there is a blob count increase in the same hard fork. And so the max EB reduction translates into the doubling of the blobs in the same hard fork. That's where that resource bandwidth went.
Well, sorry, resource bandwidth in the way of like in the people implementing it, or resource bandwidth as a like the actual network itself?
So with max EB, we get to consolidate all the validators down to fewer boxes, so there's less gossip, so there's less bandwidth overhead. So we can take that bandwidth overhead and apply it to growing the blobs, which is why that's happening.
So
in
they're
the same,
comfortable making the change because it comes with that reduction. Okay, so you can roughly equate that size is what you're saying.
No, I don't. I'm not technical enough to be able to say that, but I know that like when I did this episode with Tim Bako, he was like, yeah, we were able to comfortably scale more blobs because we have a bandwidth reduction from MaxEB. I think, and they're likely being conservative here, so there's probably more blobs that they could introduce because they just don't know how much bandwidth overhead that they are saving, and it's also not going to be instantaneous. And so there's a transition period for everyone to consolidate their validators.
Right.
And so bandwidth is going to come down incrementally over the weeks and months, and maybe there's a long tail, and so where there will be increasingly more bandwidth overhead unlocked as time goes on. So it's not immediately available day one, but they are making that trade-off of like, okay, we feel safe doubling blob bandwidth because we know we are saving bandwidth from MaxEB, but in terms of actual numbers, it's more of just like we need this to actually like wait and see.
Nice.
Yeah, and part of it comes down to nobody really knows exactly where we're going to end up. I mean, you can make some reasonable assumptions, but after it goes live, we'll just have to see how many people consolidate to what extent and over what time period, because you're probably not going to see everyone just consolidate right away as much as they possibly can, because they just don't need to or don't care.
Yeah, Coinbase is not doing this on day one.
Yeah, exactly. That's just not going to happen. So we'll end up seeing where it goes. But to the point we were talking earlier on Bread there, which I definitely agree on, of like, yeah, when you put these numbers in context of like compare these, like, all right, the numbers that Ethereum is talking about doing 3, 4, 5, whatever years down the road is like literally where other chains like Celestia are today, like where EigenDA and these Avail and these others, like you go ahead a few years. I mean, these other chains could be orders of magnitude ahead. A lot of what kind of colors my view somewhat on the prioritization of like L1 scaling versus blob scaling and stuff like this is you need to ask yourself if you accept that as just a reasonable order of magnitude statement of fact that, hey, Ethereum is like never going to be this thing that is doing a gazillion transactions. It's like everything. There's no place for AltDA, or at minimum, this is not happening in the medium term. Like if this happens, this is like a decade away or whatever, where you figured all your fancy cryptography, whatever, end game stuff. Like it's not happening anytime soon. The thing that you kind of need to ask yourself then is like, all right, if we accepted that like Ethereum is never going to be the end game for all of this stuff, for the most part, like there's going to be a bunch of other providers that are just doing orders of magnitude more scale. What is the more valuable market for you that Ethereum can provide and own? Is it premium execution or is it premium DA? Like which of those is a more valuable market that Ethereum is better at? And I think it's definitely premium execution. That it is like absolutely winning on that. It is a way more valuable market in general, and it's a much stickier market to keep onto those network effects. So that's why when I'm like always thinking of like, do I prefer, like if you had to pick, like do we scale the execution budget or add a few more blobs, you know, double the gas limit on the L1 versus double the blob limit? I actually think like most of the L1 scaling stuff of like reducing block times and increasing gas there actually gets you a lot more bang for your buck, just because that is just like a much more valuable use of that same commodity that you have.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think even when I asked Tankrad in the episode that we did with Tankrad and Namsgar, I asked about like, how can we like lower slot times? And even despite being very bullish on increasing the gas limit, lowering block time, Scott pushed back just for technical reasons.
Yeah, it's hard.
It's hard. And it's hard with while preserving Ethereum's level of decentralization. But like, I think lowering block times is more important than raising block size because of all the benefits that come with trading. And, you know, despite all of the pushback I've given Solana over the years, the decentralized NASDAQ line looks really good when Wall Street is trying to come on chain. Ethereum does have this very strong advantage of all of the MEV infrastructure, all the MEV, the very sophisticated MEV mitigation infrastructure that it has built in line with the layer one. So like the Andy 8052s of the world don't mind getting the 10% like MEV of the Solana blockchain because he's going for like a 1 million X on his meme coin token. But Wall Street definitely cares about like bips of extraction coming out from middleman in their execution. And that is Ethereum. That's something that Ethereum has invested in. And we should repurpose that and like turn that into our narrative for what Ethereum can bring to Wall Street and why assets should be minted on the Ethereum layer one. And in order to really maximize that, Ethereum needs to lower block times. It needs to have faster blocks. So trading can happen faster because that's what, you know, a decentralized NASDAQ needs. That's my hot take. I don't think that hot, actually.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm constantly reiterating that it doesn't ever have to be the decentralized NASDAQ in the same way that Solana is trying to be. But like, you know, we mentioned the properties of like your MAV mitigation, your decentralization, all those things, like those are hugely valuable things. So like there's potentially a world that, you know, once you hit a certain threshold of value, you're like, okay, I want to put it in a place that is credibly neutral, that is live, that like all of those things make sense to be done on, like, you know, we talked about the Biddle fund earlier, right? Like, you put treasuries on chain, maybe it makes sense to put them in something that that is, you know, has all of those properties as opposed to something that is just like, will settle, you know, 5 seconds faster or whatever, right? They mentioned that the actual movement of the BlackRock wallets is, you know, very infrequent, right? They're not on there degenning with that stuff daily, right? It's not something that's highly active, but it's highly valuable, right? And like, that's the key thing. And this kind of like, you know, I know all of us are basically on the same side when it comes to this conversation, but, you know, we had the recent Solana upgrade that like everyone's having controversy around whether or not you draw those lines, you know, as it like being a determiner of whether it's centralized or not, is a separate conversation. But, you know, if people are doing it inside of Ethereum, maybe there's a few people outside of our ecosystem that would draw those same lines, you know, correctly or incorrectly, whatever. And if that line can be drawn, if that narrative can be a narrative, then like, you know, maybe people would draw their line and stand on the Ethereum side and use that as a reason to put all of their funds on Ethereum because of this one event, even if they don't agree with it or we don't agree with it.
As far as this, you know, what is the type of market that Ethereum can win, even in the world where it's never going to be the fastest? The kind of like implicit assumption in there is that you're assuming all of the activity doesn't naturally gravitate to that other place that's faster anyway, even though it doesn't strictly need it. Because the world where you can see that happening is, let's just say, make it really simple. It's just Ethereum and Solana and say that, okay, Solana is the faster one. So very naturally, all of the actual decentralized NASDAQ, like most of the, like all of the stuff that really requires like low latency trading, whatever, everything goes over there. Everything naturally gravitates there. So if all the trading is there and all the users are progressively, a lot of users moving there over time, do you just naturally end up having this momentum of like, okay, all the lending stuff naturally like moves there too, because people trust it with the high value stuff and people are going there. My guess is that's at least directionally true. It's definitely net positive, but to what extent is that true? Does it pull everything? Like, what time horizon does that actually happen on? Leaves, like, in my mind, in general, just a very large market segment, if nothing else, that Ethereum like should be capitalizing on now, because that's definitely not the case now, and I don't think it's going to be happening anytime soon. That, you know, when the, you know, you're just putting treasuries on chain or whatever, like, oh, it has to go on Solana because like they have better trading infrastructure than Ethereum L1, like, and better than everyone else. We're just not there. Like, there's clearly a big market edge that, like, at minimum for you to grab there.
Understanding that all this stuff is permissionless, we're talking about like just the market structure of all this stuff. I saw Eric Wall made a post because he's in the Bitcoin world and Bitcoin is now starting their journey of like really digging into these L2 architectures, right? Or these multi-chain architectures. He said, you know, what lessons learned should we take from what happened here? Like, how, if you were designing from scratch, how would you implement a multi-chain roadmap, understanding that it's all permissionless, right? People are going to build however they want. And we're likely going to see some fractals over there of the exact same stuff that we saw here. People are going to say, I'm going to build a chain that is going to be the hub of a bunch of chains on top of the chain. And like, that's going to rerun itself. But how would you guys, what are the lessons learned of Ethereum that you would implement in a Bitcoin multi-chain world?
I mean, part of my concern is just in general over analogizing between the two, because I do think that you have at least like pretty, and I mean, this was a lot of like what I'd written in like the Bitcoin L2 thesis post that I'd written of like, I do think that at least some parts of this will end up playing out meaningfully different in Bitcoin L2s versus Ethereum L2s, because I think that you have a fundamentally just different user base across the two of like, users are just looking for a different thing when I'm going to go use a Bitcoin L2 versus an Ethereum L2. Like, Ethereum L2 is mostly like, I want to go do this thing faster and cheaper that I can kind of already do on the L1, and you're just like going for a different kind of use case there. Versus Bitcoin, like, most of this stuff is a pretty 0-to-1 of like, hey man, I can't do any trustless basic DeFi stuff with my Bitcoin. If like I want to swap or do lending or just basic, you know, deposit into a vault, whatever, like I got to go trust BlockFi or whatever to go use the thing for the most part. So I'm somewhat hesitant to over analogize on these things, because I do actually expect the market to play out a little bit differently. If I do think that users do actually want to do different things. And then another part of it is also the constraints just technically are very different. Of like Bitcoin is like way smaller block sizes even than Ethereum, and it's way slower. It's got proof of work. You don't actually have ZK verification right now. So I'm hesitant to just overdraw like too many analogies on the way that like Ethereum has played out so far.
The notion of Bitcoin users always that throws a flag in my mind. It's like there are no users of Bitcoin. There are holders of the Bitcoin asset, but users of the Bitcoin blockchain, I'm not sure that is a cohort, TAM.
People who trade ordinals.
Yeah, but those people are the same people who came over to Ethereum to trade NFTs and are happy to trade meme coins on Solana too. So I think the overlap between Bitcoin ordinals traders and like pump.fund meme coin traders on Solana is actually pretty high. And then people always look at the market cap of Bitcoin like, man, there's so much like potential. There's so much potential here. There's so much like we could put into Bitcoin DeFi, but that implies like the existence of this like large Bitcoin user base that I don't think exists.
I still think Desire is 1-to-1. I'd go against you on that, John. I think like because if you think about the overlap with Ethereum,
it's not just Desire, to be clear. It's what fundamentally like can they do and already not do. Like Ethereum is already servicing a lot of the stuff that Bitcoin L2s will need to fundamentally service because Bitcoin can't do it. It's not just like user desire. Like I don't think BTC and ETH holders actually have that different of a desire across their holder bases. I think that Ethereum and Bitcoin provide like very fundamentally different things, and so that changes what L2 should do in reflection. So it's not a user desire thing. It's like I think that everything is downstream of what the L1 looked like, so the L2s need to provide like a fundamentally different thing.
Yeah. In addition to renaming this show the Meme Coin Show, I think this is also going to have to be renamed to the Bread versus Drawn Bitcoin Layer 2 show as well. That is also becoming a reoccurring theme on this episode. Bread, Andy, John, it's another week. Really appreciate you guys coming on and joining the roundtable, and I look forward to talking to you guys again in one more week.
Thanks for having us, man. Until next week.
Bangle Station, you guys know the deal. Crypto is risky. You can lose what you put in. But nonetheless, we are headed west. This is Frontier. It's not for everyone, but we are glad you are with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.